Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Sloan. As a high school science teacher for 3 decades, I'm always amazed by the enthusiasm and talents of young people. But once in a while, you run across someone who's truly exceptional. In this show, you're going to meet Ellery McQuilkin, a junior at Lee Vining High School in Mono County, which is on the eastern slope of the Sierra Nevada Range adjacent to Yosemite National Park near the shores of Mono Lake. Her interest in the Sierra Nevada's rapidly shrinking glaciers led her to an important field study of a glacier in the Ansel Adams Wilderness near Yosemite. Ellery's amazing science fair entry is entitled Quantifying Volume of the Dana Glacier Using Field Measurements and 3D Modeling, and it's earned her trips to the California State Science and Engineering Fair and the Regeneron International Science and Engineering Fair. Later on in the show, we'll talk to her advisor, Yosemite National Park geologist Greg Stock. But first, let's visit with Ellery McQuilkin, who joined us from her home in Lee Vining, California. Ellery McQuilkin, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Hey, I want to know, first of all, we're going to talk about your science fair project in just a bit. I want to know, how did you first get interested in the topic of your project, which is Dana Glacier? How did that first get on your radar and capture your interest?
Yeah, well, it's been, a developing process. I started doing the science fair when I think I was in fifth grade, and the school was doing it at that point. So that was sort of where things started. And I was looking at, does a big lake freeze faster than a small lake? So I started at this pretty basic point, but, it was environmental science sort of from the beginning. And then I went to the regional science fair and did well there. So I got to go to the state fair. So I sort of had this experience of moving on and meeting people who were doing other science fair projects and really learning a lot. So I kept doing it even after my school stopped sponsoring the science fair. Mono County, the Board of Education was really great and sort of kept it running. So I was still able to do it. It was a great learning experience, a great experience in general. So they really just developed into the research I've been doing now. But sort of the one that connected me the most to glaciers was my freshman year project, when I was looking at stream flow in 3 different watersheds, one that had the Dana Glacier above it, and then 2 that had no watersheds. So I could see the effect of glacial melt on stream flow. And that sort of brought me up to the Dana Glacier. And then from there, I started doing this more in-depth research on the Dana Glacier.
Okay, let's talk about your project. First of all, I always love the title of really cool scientific papers. Tell us the title of your project.
Yeah, the title of my project is Quantifying Volume of the Dana Glacier Using Field Measurements and 3D Modeling.
Perfect. Yes, that's wonderful. Well, let's talk about the methodology, because you had to go up and do a lot of work up at the glacier. When did you do this? When was the actual field study done?
Yeah, so I did this in the summer of 2020, and it was supposed to happen in early September, which is sort of the ideal time because all the snow has melted away, so you're really looking at ice. But it hasn't snowed yet, so there's no layer of anything on top. But during September, there were the crazy wildfires. So the Inyo National Forest actually shut down, and I had to get emergency permission to go in and conduct the research. So I ended up going a month later than planned in October. It was quite cold, but the weather worked out, so it was still pretty successful.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, when you said summer of 2020, I was like, that was the most epic, terrible wildfire season in California history.
No, so it was insane.
Oh, yeah, that had a big impact on you. Okay, well, let's talk about some of the methodology you used, because you had to get a really interesting piece of equipment, a steam drill. Tell us about that and how you got it.
Yes, so the steam drill is a piece of specialized ice equipment. They're not very common, and they're really just designed specifically for drilling or melting holes on ice. And because the Dana Glacier is so small, I determined that I would be able to actually drill down to bedrock in a few places, which is how I was able to model the volume of the glacier. So the steam drill, I determined, was the best piece of equipment to do this work. And I reached out to a bunch of professors. My dad is working, he's working in the science community. So we had a lot of connections. So I sort of sent out an email to a bunch of people, and I was like, hey, I'm trying to do this work. do any of you have ideas about where I could find a steam drill? And I had a couple of leads, but none of them really worked until I basically just out of the blue emailed this professor from Montana State University. And he was like, do you have any experience using the steam drill? And I told him no, but my advisor had used this type. And he was like, great. And let me borrow the steam drill. And it was pretty fantastic. So thank you, Jordy Hendricks. It made a huge difference.
So did they just ship it to you?
Yeah, he just shipped it over. He was awesome. It was really amazing just how smoothly the process went. And then I had a steam drill in my front yard.
And give us a sense of how big of a piece of equipment this is. Describe it to us a little bit.
Yeah, so it's the size sort of a backpack. I wore it on my back and hiked up to the glacier. But, you know, it's metal, so it sticks out a lot farther than you would expect. But it's not like sort of if you imagine a backpacking pack that's full, it's shorter than that and a little bit wider, but sort of it's quite small considering all that it does.
Yeah. And did you practice with it in your yard before you took it up there?
We did. Yeah. We just, you know, you fill it up with water and get it going. And I sprayed the steam at the grass in my front yard, which did kill it. But it was a good practice round.
Uh-huh. All right. Well, when you go up to Dana Glacier, give us a sense of, you know, how long a hike that is, because that's I know where it is. I've been there. It's up in the Ansel Adams Wilderness. But give our listeners a sense of what kind of a hike it is to get up into that location.
Yeah. So it's not a super far hike. It's like 4.5 miles in, but the trail is really only there for the first 2 miles. And then it's just talus, and there are these big glacial moraines of talus also. And because this is, you know, in a geological time scale, pretty newly uncovered, it's really loose and hasn't settled as much as other talus. So it takes some work just, you know, for about 2 miles, you're moving over this super loose and in places really steep piles of talus.
Wow.
So it takes some work to get up there, but the distance wise isn't too far.
And how long did you stay there?
So for this project, it was a 2-day trip, and we camped overnight there at Dana Lake, which is just sort of right beneath the glacier. It was one of the coolest places I've ever camped, actually, because you're just totally above the tree line. So you're just surrounded by talus, and we had this spectacular view. It was a very exposed campsite, but it was pretty fantastic.
Yeah, that really literally is the High Sierra, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
Okay, so when you look at pictures of Dana Glacier, which is what this is really all about, like mm-hmm. from the 1800s, like I imagine, and I think you've probably thought about this too, when John Muir was trekking through there, and mm-hmm. could you describe to us what did the glacier look like then compared to now?
Yeah, so there's actually a photo point where in 1883, Israel Russell took this photo, and then we found that same photo point and have been recreating it for the past 2 or 3 years. So there's sort of this really clear visual from all these historic images compared to now. But the glacier had a much larger surface area. There's sort of this basin that it's in, and it's really retreated up the side of one of it, where the headwall is the steepest, you know, right under the top of Mount Dana, because that's where it's getting the most shade. So the other parts have melted out. But before, the glacier used to fill this whole basin, but it was also just a lot taller. It's deflated a lot. So the Dana Couloir, which people go to ice climb and stuff like that, used to be this sort of just much easier hike up, and it was this cool thing to do. But now it's this super narrow canyon because it's just deflating. So there's really not that much ice in there. So it used to be a lot bigger, and just it had a lot more vertical height also.
And I think there's probably a lot of people would be surprised that the Sierra Nevada has glaciers, or, you know, that's something that maybe not all people know. That let our listeners know, what about the Sierra glaciers is really special to you?
Yeah, so this has actually sort of been one of the things I've been trying to get across with my science fair projects, is that, you know, these glaciers are here, and they're really small. They're cirque glaciers, so they've retreated back up against these headwalls. They're sort of just, you know, clinging on in these pieces of shade. But, I mean, the Dana Glacier is still moving. You know, it's an actual glacier. And even though they're small, there are just sort of these miraculous things that happen. You know, the first time I was on the Dana Glacier measuring movement, as we were putting in the stakes, we actually felt it move. There was just this sort of jerk and you could almost hear it and you barely felt it. You know, it was tiny, but you could feel it. So this is sort of crazy moment where I really hadn't expected that it was moving at that point. And then we felt that and we were all just like, oh my gosh, what happened?
Wow.
There's
that's almost like, you know, experiencing the living ice, kind of a sense of that. That's
yeah,
really cool.
No, totally. And, you know, to take that farther, the Dana Glacier had this, when we went this time, had this little mini ice cave. It didn't really go back very far. But you would go up underneath the bottom of the glacier and there were these rocks on top and you could see how it had shaped to rocks that it was, the pieces of bedrock that it was going over. And it was sort of just, you know, this beautiful thing that it's really moving, you know, it is almost alive and that sort of a magical experience on the Dana Glacier. And then as far as other ones in the Sierra, the McClure Glacier, which I visited with my advisor, has this ice cave that went back even farther. And, you know, you go in there and it's dark and you have a headlamp and there were just these ice crystals growing off like the bedrock. And they were in these beautiful shapes like fans of ice. And it was honestly one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. So there are lots of just, you know, hidden details in these glaciers that people might often miss because they're so small that you sort of think, oh, it's a patch of ice. But no, they have these aspects that really make them feel alive almost.
And they're also very important for the watersheds below them. And maybe tell us a bit about, you know, the impact of a shrinking glacier is going to have on some of the creeks that, you know, they feed.
Yeah. So glaciers are melting and there's sort of a natural melt that occurs in the summer that is good in that doesn't feed a lot of water, but a little bit to streams down canyon. And it's not a significantly huge amount of water, but the important thing about it is that it's consistent. So it's going all throughout the summer, whereas the snowpack melts and there's a bunch of water for a while, but then the snow has all melted away. And in a lot of cases, it's just this small amount of glacial melt that's still keeping these streams running. So that makes the riparian habitat, you know, it's not an ephemeral stream. So it has this more rich riparian habitat and it's just continuous throughout this year. So it's this reliable water source.
Okay. Well, tell us about, you know, the process that you go through. Okay. You're drilling these holes in the glacier to determine the depth, right? Mm-hmm. And what kinds of data are you collecting there and how are you collecting it? Are you doing that digitally in a notebook? How are you collecting this information while you're out in the field?
Yeah. So I have this little notebook that has waterproof paper and I'd basically just write the numbers into it. The steam drill is it's a pretty simple process using the steam drill, more so than you might expect. It's sort of designed to be efficient and work well, which it really does do. So you drill down and then you just pull up the hose and measure that length. So we would pull out after we had reached bedrock or the maximum hose length depth, then we would just measure that and I would write it down in my notebook. But with other research I've done, that's sort of been more complicated and there's been putting stakes into the glacier and then measuring those exact positions with other research equipment. But yeah, no, you know, there's not reception out there, but it's also pretty wet and cold. So yeah, just a notebook and a pencil has been my go-to.
Yeah, like so many field scientists before you.
Yeah. No, it's pretty cool to look back at them because I'll write down notes about, you know, the temperature, the conditions. Is there a lot of surface melt? What's going on? And you can also just tell how cold it is based on my handwriting. You know, am I writing with my gloves on shivering or are my gloves off because it's warm and I'm doing well?
Yeah.
So it's sort of fun to see.
Yeah. And you're scrambling around on ice too. So you have to be wearing crampons and, you know, some pretty specialized equipment, right?
Yeah. That's sort of been one of the most awesome things is that, yeah, when you're on the Dana Glacier, you have crampons, you have ice axes. Sometimes we had belay lines going. And this was something I had no experience in. But the first time we went to the Dana Glacier, my advisor got this mountaineer, Josh Helling, who was absolutely amazing. And he just sort of gave us a safety lesson and really like introduced me to how to move around on the ice in a super safe way. So it was fantastic because I've sort of always been with people and then just gotten lessons about how to move around on it safely. So that's really been a cool, you know, a cool thing that, like, that's sort of a capability that I have now.
Yeah, you learned some skills.
Yeah.
You used LiDAR data, right?
Yeah.
So tell us about the LiDAR data you used and how you acquired that.
Yeah, so the LiDAR data is basically, I had super high 3-meter resolution, just data points of the terrain around the Damon Glacier. Well, I actually had it for a bunch of watersheds. And the program that gives it to me just switched, but it used to be part of JPL's Snowborne Observatory program. And then my dad had a connection there, so I was sort of emailing with him, and then the woman who processes the data, I made a connection with her. So I sort of reach out to her cat who works there every year, and I'm like, hey, can I get some of the newest LiDAR data, you know?
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the disappearing Sierra glaciers and a study conducted by high school student Ellery McQuilkin, examining the glacier that sits below Mount Dana. It's a 13,000-foot-high peak that sits on the boundary between the Ansel Adams Wilderness and Yosemite National Park. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. This is Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom, and we're talking to Lee Vining High School student Ellery McQuilkin about her science project examining the Dana Glacier in California's Sierra Nevada Mountains. Ellery qualified for science fairs at the state and international level with her study. Well, you've mentioned your advisor a couple of times. Tell us about this person and their role in this and how they've helped you.
Yeah, so my advisor is Greg Stock, and he's the Yosemite National Park geologist. And he's been doing, you know, he's the geologist of Yosemite National Park, so there's a lot particularly with rock falls, but he's also been doing research on the Lyell and McClure glaciers. That was sort of what I was interested in. And yeah, he's been super fantastic and giving me advice. He's gone on most of these trips with me and really just sort of, you know, given me some introductions to this field, but also given me a lot of space to sort of work things out and figure things out. But yeah, no, he's been really amazing. Also, Connie Millar, her expertise isn't in glacier science, but she's from the beginning of the science fair. She's been there letting me borrow equipment and things like that, and just, you know, being this really great advisor. And just, they're both two scientists who, you know, the scientific method, just have advice about and know how all those things work. So they've both been really fantastic people and definitely helped me stay passionate about science and keep things going.
Yeah, and we'll talk some more about your passion for science in a bit, but let's get down to some of the less glamorous parts. As most, you know, all the scientists I know, it's like the really fun stuff is when you go out in the field, but the really hard work is when you get back. Yeah. And you have to do something with all this data. Tell us about some of the work you had to do to actually process this and turn this into an actual study.
That was sort of a new realm for me. My advisor connected me with one of the people he had worked with, Nikita, and he sort of gave me some advice and suggested that I use Cloud Compare and sort of showed me a little bit about his process. And then I sort of looked at that and developed my own process. What he was doing was really complicated, so I sort of did this in a simpler but also effective way. But the basic idea is that I had these points from a steam drill, and there were 5 of them. So to have a few more depth data points, I used the Cloud Compare software and basically took a cross-section of the glacier. So I just had this tool where you could slide across the glacier and all the surrounding terrain in different points. And then I would take those cross sections. And when you look at the glacier from that point, the ice surface sort of rises up. And then there's sort of just this gap where you can see, oh, the bedrock should, you know, fill in this curve. So I would sort of just draw that in. And this is pretty rough, but gives you a general idea. And then from that, in the Cloud Compare processing software, I had put sort of a measurement factor. So just 2 meter points that descended from the ice surface. And then roughly from where my line crossed those points, I could sort of get a general idea of the depth. So from that, I had about 12 depth points to work with on the glacier. And then ArcPro has these interpolation tools that basically just connect these depth points and make them into a surface. So there are four of them. So I used all four of the interpolation tools and I made these four different bedrock surfaces. And I put those back into Cloud Compare, which has much better visualization for these 3D sort of created surfaces. And then just sort of based on my field experience, and I was able to figure out which bedrock surface was the most reasonable prediction.
So you're having to like model what this bedrock is like that the glacier is sitting on top of. Wow.
Yeah. And that's sort of, you know, the crux of this, because you're trying to model something that nobody's actually ever seen. So you're really just creating something that seems reasonable. And, you know, you could do this without going into the field, but you have no reasonability check from that, which is why with the steam drill, I had, you know, a point where I had reached bedrock, and then I had these minimum depths where we'd exceeded the maximum drilling depth. So when I was drawing in these sort of imaginary bedrock lines, I could see where these minimum depths were and sort of adjust based on that. So it really helped me actually have a reasonable idea of what would make sense. And then just being on the glacier also, you sort of get an idea of, no, you know, it doesn't get super deep right here. It's still thin. So that was really good to have that connection.
How long, like, give us a sense of how much time you're putting into this, like on a daily, nightly, weekly basis. And how long did it take to get this project from your field study where you collected all the data and did the drilling to where it's a finished product and ready to go to science fair?
Yeah, so the field work was, you know, 2 solid days of work, but there was a lot of preparation trying to find the steam drill, applying for a permit, which is a complicated process. But the field work, you know, 2 solid days of pretty intense work. And then the modeling, I mean, I spent hours on it, particularly in the beginning when I was just sort of stuck with this one thing in ArcPro, and I was just trying to make it do this function that it's not really designed to do. And, you know, I probably spent 6 hours trying to figure it out. And then I talked with Nikita, who had done bedrock modeling for the Lyell McClure glaciers and had worked with my advisor. And he sort of gave me some advice and was like, oh, you should try Cloud Compare because you can actually see these models much better. So he was really helpful and just sort of like gave me the one piece of information where I could sort of connect the dots. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is how I do it. And then from there, you know, it was probably another 5 to 6 hours of work getting it all to go. But, you know, that was good work because I was making progress. I was figuring things out. So that was all super exciting.
Yeah. And then you've got to present all this. And, you know, when people think of science fair, they think of, I don't know, 5th and 6th graders with their piece of poster board and, you know, hand lettered with my hypothesis and procedure and conclusions. And, you know, here's my data, and might have some bar graph or something. And it can be really fun, but it can also be really cheesy. You've put together something that's, you know, looks exactly like what you would see at a professional presentation of a poster session at like the Geological Society of America or someplace like that. So tell us about how you went about, you know, making this really look good and publishing it.
Yeah. So, you know, this year with everything being virtual, it's been a different process because normally I do have a board and there are printouts on it. And, you know, I always put a fair amount of work into making things look nice on it because I just sort of find that satisfying. But then moving on to the International Science Fair, the San Bernardino County actually printed all of our boards for us. So my board was basically just printed on this piece of material that I would roll out. So that was really exciting because that sort of added this new layer of just sort of feeling more professional. But for the state fair, they wanted it in a PowerPoint. And this was sort of just, you know, a transition, like just a different way to represent it. So it wasn't too hard to make the switch, but instead of having this board with a bunch of text on it, you know, I had this PowerPoint that couldn't be more than 12 slides. But so that's sort of been an interesting transition to make, but I think it's also helpful because it's sort of, it's good because it helps you figure out how you can convey your results in a more concise way that makes more sense. So I always think that it's good to sort of have this transition between how you're presenting.
Yeah. And let's back up just a little bit. When you've got this project going and you're ready to go with it, what's like, was it the regional science fair? Was that the first place that you presented your work?
So the first place I could present my work is at my county. Now, for most people, you start at your school, but my school doesn't actually do the science fair. But the county has been really great and is actually still putting it on. So generally, I go to the Mono County Board of Education office and I set up and they get a few judges who, you know, are sort of, some of them are scientists. Some of them have sort of a relationship with water. It's actually been super cool. I've had a lot of the same judges over the years, so it's been fun. You sort of get to meet them and know more about the work they do. So I present there. Nobody else in my division is doing the science fair, so there's never like, oh, I might not make it to the regional fair. But I mean, they do judge and see if I've done something reasonable. And then, yeah, I go to the regional fair, which is in San Bernardino. And then there are a bunch of kids because, you know, it's the San Bernardino school district and then the Mono district. So that's just me.
So were you the only kid like from the Eastern Sierra region, or how was there anybody else?
When the school first stopped doing it, my sister and I were both doing the science fair, but we were never in the same division. So it was never like we were competing against each other. But then she stopped doing the science fair when she got into high school. So I think for maybe 3 years, it was just me. And then 2 years ago, a new student, a fourth grader, did a science fair project and I sort of gave her some advice about that. So it was cool. I got to do a little bit of mentoring myself and she participated in the science fair. And then this year, another boy in fourth grade also started doing the science fair, and I was able to sort of give him some advice too. So it's been two people for maybe the past 4 years.
And what do you think about, you know, for somebody like you who's definitely interested in science and nature, how important is it to you to convey that to like to other kids, you know, that might be, you know, or parents listening to this program about the importance of getting kids involved in something like science fair and just the study and appreciation of nature on a deeper level like what you're doing?
Yeah, I think it's really important because, you know, this is a big aspect of the world that is sometimes glossed over. I think normally people are pretty aware, but I think when you're doing your own research in the outdoors, you sort of come to have this greater knowledge of it, which is really valuable. So I think it's important that people sort of understand that and sort of just get to see that process where you can ask a question and then you can sort of, you know, find out the answer. And I think that's sort of this kind of miraculous concept that's important to know about.
And what about the vehicle of science fair itself? It's, you know, it's kind of an iconic thing, but at the same time, as you've pointed out, and as I've observed myself, there are not a lot of schools that do science fairs well at all. But on, you know, when you get into some of the larger, you know, like urban areas, the Bay Area with the, you know, high tech industry down there in Southern California, places, you know, hovering around the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, then you start to see, you know, a lot of really high quality, high powered stuff. So what do you think about the value of the science fair experience overall?
I think whether you're interested in science or not, science fair is super valuable because you learn how to talk about this thing that you've put a fair amount of work in to other people. So it's sort of just, if you don't have a great interest in the science, you don't want to be a scientist in the future, you know, whatever, you learn this process, one, where you can ask a question and sort of find out this answer, which is a really great experience. But you also just learn how to talk about more complex things with people who you might not know. And I think for me, that's been one of the most valuable experiences I've seen myself gain a ton of confidence from science fair. You know, when I was little, I had horrible stage fright. I was always just like afraid of that kind of thing. And then I really started to do the science fair and just talking to a lot of people. And I sort of figured out, you know, if I've prepared enough, if I feel like I know pretty well what I'm talking about, then like, I don't have to be afraid, you know, it can be good. I'm going to learn something. And that's sort of this amazing experience that I think anybody can get out of science fair, which is why I think it's super valuable for schools to do it, because that sort of gives everybody this starting place to sort of gain some confidence in just public speaking, you know?
Yeah. And presenting, you know, information to other people is an important part of almost any kind of job you could possibly do.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And the other aspect of this that I find fascinating is you're the only person that's really ever done a field study of Dana Glacier. Is that right?
Yeah. So, I mean, some people have done sort of, it's complicated because not all of it is super well documented, but I think about 50 years ago, the National Park or USGS sort of went out and did some field studies, but they weren't super in depth and they never really returned to like keep that process going. And then a few other scientists, particularly of note, Hassan Basajic, did some sort of, he wasn't necessarily in the field like I was, but he was looking at glaciers all across the Sierra. I think that was more of sort of a remote project where he went out to some of them, but it was sort of more of like a surface area type of thing. But yeah, I mean, in the last 50 years, I'm really the only person who has done this, you know, in-depth field research on the Dana Glacier. And definitely volume on the Dana Glacier had never been evaluated before. And I don't, movement had never been evaluated so precisely before also.
Yeah. And that's what struck me about what was so important about your work is it's like, it's great. It's science fair and that's wonderful. But it's also important scientific work in its own right, because nobody's done this before, really.
Yeah. That was sort of an exciting thing that happened last year and this year where I was like, wow, I'm really figuring out information that doesn't exist. And that was sort of a super exciting thing that sort of was different from my other science fair projects where I was asking questions and the answer didn't necessarily clearly wasn't laid out in the terms of the question I was asking. But, you know, you could sort of expect like, oh yeah, this is what's going to happen. And I was sort of quantifying that. But in this project and last year's project, I was really figuring out this new information, and that was super exciting.
Yeah. And of course, hanging all over this and over, you know, your life as a young person who's definitely interested in science and nature and the environment is climate change. And how much has your work on this, you know, how much does that inform, you know, the way you think about it when you're seeing what's happened to this glacier over time?
Yeah. So definitely climate change has been something I'm looking at. Glaciers are a very good indicator of the state of our current climate. And definitely at the Dana Glacier, it's showing us that our climate is not in a great state. It's also, I think, made my research feel, you know, just more special to myself, because with the work I did this year, you know, sort of depending on the snow years, but if we have a bunch of average winters, basically in 8 years, the Dana Glacier is going to be gone. And that sort of, you know, puts almost a little bit of urgency to me and urgency into my work, where I feel like, you know, I want to get out there and figure out as much as I can before it's gone. And I think that that's sort of a feeling for a lot of the glaciers in this year, because they're all melting really rapidly. And you sort of, you want to figure this stuff out while they're still, you know, sort of alive, almost, is the best way to say it.
Yeah. Well, and another thing I find interesting is, you know, I'm thinking about you at, well, like 16 years old, right? Are you 16?
Yeah.
Okay. You're 16 and, you know, that's not very old. You haven't had a lot of years on the planet. And then you're in these places where, you know, you described the cirque there where the glacier is, sits below Mount Dana, as geologically pretty young. And yet, you know, when you're talking about geologic time, you know, it's still, those are vast spanses of time. When you're up in the mountains and you're doing these studies, do you ever, you know, think about it in terms of, you know, the depth of time, you know, that abyss of time, almost like looking into a super deep lake? Does that ever something that strikes you at your age?
Yeah, I mean, definitely just standing on the glacier and thinking, you know, pretty soon this isn't going to be here. And then also that it has been there for so long before that, like, so suddenly it's just going to be gone when it has seemed sort of like this permanent fixture is definitely something that I've felt. And sort of that idea of time passing in the glacier in other ways, because when I was in those ice caves underneath the glacier, you know, that's pretty old ice on top of you. So you almost, and drilling on the glacier too, I could feel the steam drill passing through different layers of ice. So not only was I feeling, wow, this thing has been here for so long, it's carved out, you know, the Sierra, these place that I've grown up backpacking through and had all of these super incredible experiences in, it's going to melt away. But then also just, you know, having that research on the glacier, also being able to sort of get a more physical, you know, look at the different, the years, the layers of ice in it. That was sort of a magical experience, but also a pretty sad one because, you know, it's going to be gone soon.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you go backpacking, like with your family or friends, when you backpack in the Sierra, for you personally, what is it about that you love, that, you know, makes you really enjoy it? What is it about backpacking that, you know, you would say to somebody who's never done it before, especially like a teenager, what would you say to them to say, hey, you should check this out, it's really cool?
Yeah, you know, I think it's just a magical experience to just be out there sort of away from everything else. And you just sort of, you get this new perspective about the world and you don't feel so centered around humans anymore. You sort of see this natural world in this beautiful state. And that's just something magical and almost grounding, really, because you sort of remember, you know, like, why am I doing this research? Why does it matter so much? Because people need to know what's happening here. And then just, you know, I think it's just really a magical experience to be out there with nature, which is so much, you know, it almost feels larger than life. It is in a lot of ways.
Well, it's certainly larger than our lives.
Yes.
Yeah. And okay, so let's talk about the near future. What's next with the science fairs? Where are you at? And like, when's the next level of competition happening for you?
Yeah, so the next level of competition is the state fair, which is actually happening next week. So that's coming up. And then the international science fair, which is the next level, which I qualified to go to at my regional science fair, is happening in mid-May.
So this year it's virtual, obviously.
Yeah, sorry. So, yeah, this year it's virtual. So, you know, on my computer.
Yeah. So I just, you know, best of luck with those, and we'll definitely be rooting for you. But what do you foresee for yourself for your future? What would you like to be when you grow up, Ellery? Because you sound pretty grown up now. Where do you see yourself going? What would you like to do educationally and professionally in the future?
Oh, I definitely want to go to a four-year college. I've been looking a lot at liberal arts schools on the East Coast. You know, my high school is so small, you know, there are 50 kids in it, so preferably a smaller one. So, you know, Amherst, Williams, Carleton are ones I've been looking at a fair amount. But yeah, I've been looking also in depth at the geology programs, because that's sort of at this point in my life thinking, yeah, I want to be a geologist. But, you know, I also love reading and writing, which is sort of why the liberal arts school appeals to me, because I can you know, learn more about all of my passions.
Well, and there's, you know, there's something to be said for being a science person who can write well and speak well and communicate. And my biggest heroes, like people like Carl Sagan, you know, they're not just great scientists, they're great communicators and poets. You know, they're just, they are able to convey, you know, the deepest of thoughts about the natural world and nature on the grandest stage of the entire cosmos, and be able to express it in such a beautiful way that I think, you know, there's a way to combine those passions.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think that's sort of part of why science fair is so good, because, you know, it's not, you get some practice trying to talk about things in a way that makes sense to other people, which can sometimes be difficult.
Well, when you're not doing, you know, glacier science, like, what's your favorite things to do just for fun?
Yeah, well, I mean, in the summer, we spend a lot of time hiking. My sister and I have done a lot of cool hikes in the Sierra and with our friends also. But yeah, I mean, particularly in the summer, we go on a lot of hikes with our friends, a lot of, you know, swimming in freezing lakes. In the winter, I'm playing sports at the school, and then skiing is happening, which is sort of my favorite. But also there are a lot of extracurriculars, so I do mock trial at school. I'm on ASB.
Hey, it was really fun talking to you.
Yeah, thank you. Have a good time.
Let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll visit with Ellery McQuilkin's advisor during her project, Yosemite National Park geologist Greg Stock. Stay with us. And we're back. Now let's turn to Ellery McQuilkin's science advisor for her project working on the Dana Glacier. Greg Stock joins us from Yosemite National Park, where he's the park's geologist. Greg Stock, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks for having me.
I'd like to know, first of all, how many, are there a lot of national park geologists?
Not really. There are maybe a dozen or so geologists who are stationed in national parks throughout the country.
And how long have you been there at Yosemite?
I started in 2006. So I've been here a good long time. It's such a great job. I don't want to go anywhere else.
Oh, I can imagine. Well, let's talk about the topic of the day, which is glaciers and the work of Ellery McQuilkin. But before we get to her, just give us a quick, you know, for people who are not as familiar as some of us are with Yosemite National Park, the role of glaciers and the geology of Yosemite Park. Give us like your Glacier 101.
Okay. Well, I'm often asked to simplify the geology of Yosemite as much as possible, and I've come down to glaciers on granite. I feel like those three words really capture most of the geology of Yosemite. The granite of the park is the bedrock. Granite's a really strong, beautiful crystalline rock, and that granite has been sculpted by multiple glacier advances and retreats over millions of years to make iconic features such as Half Dome, El Capitan, Cathedral Peak. So really, I would say that Yosemite owes its status as a national park to glaciers and the erosion that glaciers have done over millions of years.
And what glaciers are there that remain in the park right now?
It actually kind of depends on how strictly you want to stick to the definition of a glacier. So within the park boundaries, we typically refer to two glaciers, the Lyell Glacier and the McClure Glacier. They are side by side at the headwaters of the Tuolumne River, underneath Mount Lyell, which is the highest peak in Yosemite at just over 13,000 feet. We have done a number of studies on those glaciers over the years, including studies of their movement. And we found some interesting things. We first found that the McClure Glacier is still moving at roughly an inch a day in the summertime, which is the same rate that John Muir measured the McClure Glacier moving back in 1872. So even though that glacier is much smaller than it was in Muir's time, it is still moving, and movement is a key part of the definition of a glacier. But the Lyell Glacier, which is, again, you know, right next door, is not moving at all. It has stagnated sometime in the past few decades, and therefore, arguably, is not really a glacier anymore.
What would you call it?
Oh, I'd call it a stagnant ice patch, which just doesn't have the same ring to it.
Yeah, not as, especially if you use the British pronunciation of glacier. ice patch, just not as much fun. Okay, let's talk about the work of Ellery McQuilkin. How did you first become aware that she wanted to do this? Tell us about the genesis of the project from your point of view and how you connected with her.
Okay. Well, I've known the McQuilkin family for a while. I do some geology seminars for the Mono Lake Committee, and Ellery's dad, Jeff, is instrumental in running the Mono Lake Committee. And I think it was probably 3 or 4 years ago, Ellery first approached me with some questions about a study that she could do for a science fair project. And, you know, she was a lot younger then. And so we identified kind of a simple project looking at microclimates on the north-facing versus the south-facing slope of a canyon. The next year, she started asking me again about a science fair project, and I had talked to her about glacier some. So she settled on a project looking at stream flow in watersheds with glaciers and without glaciers. And she found, you know, some kind of obvious but really interesting patterns, which is that in the late summer and fall, those watersheds with glaciers in them have a lot more water in the streams than those that don't. Illustrating the buffering effects that glaciers have on stream systems, especially in an era of climate change and drought. So after that, I think she really got interested in glaciers. And for the past 2 years, Ellery has done studies measuring the movement of two glaciers that are just outside of the park, the Thuna Glacier and the Dana Glacier. And then this past year, she continued those studies and also worked to try to estimate the volume of remaining ice in the glaciers, which is really the last piece of information you need in order to make a decent prediction for when the glaciers are going to disappear.
And how unique is it that someone her age, a high school student, is doing a study like this in the Yosemite Park region there? It's in the Ansel Adams Wilderness areas where her study was, right?
Yeah, in the Forest Service Wilderness areas just outside the mm-hmm. park. Well, I don't know of any other examples, certainly not in the field of geology. I have to say, I feel like Ellery is just uniquely motivated to learn about glaciers, to generate new information about the glaciers. I can hardly think of a time when I was pushing Ellery. I feel like more often she was pushing me to try to tackle some problem that for one reason or another, I was a little bit reluctant to take on. So,
can you give us an example of that?
Well, sure. Putting stakes in the Kuna Glacier. I mean, I remember specifically she was asking me about the Kuna Glacier and what was known. And I said, well, you know, actually compared to the other glaciers in the Central Sierra, not very much is known. It's a little bit tucked away and scientists haven't really focused on it. And she was wondering, well, is it still moving or not? And I had to admit, I didn't know. And I remember her asking, well, what would it take to figure that out? I said, well, you know, you'd probably need to put in some stakes and go back repeatedly throughout the summer and measure those and you GPS and laser rangefinders, et cetera. And she just said, well, can we do that? Do you have that equipment? And I said, well, yeah, I guess we could. So she really was the motivating force in almost everything that she's done. My role was really to help her logistically, to give her a little, you know, to give her some tips along the way. Well, you might try to do this or think about this when you're making the measurements, and then to check her math in the end. But she, as I said, she's remarkably motivated young scientist.
And could you give us a sense of the significance of her study? You know, what has it taught you, for example, about the glacier system there?
You know, in many ways, I think that the glaciers that Ellery is studying, they are variations on a theme in terms of the state of glaciers throughout the Sierra Nevada and throughout California and throughout the Western U.S. They are all shrinking rapidly as the climate warms, and the impacts that that has on the downstream stream systems, the ecosystems, you know, we're still learning more about that, but there's really no question that when the glaciers disappear entirely, it's going to have ripple effects throughout the alpine ecosystems of the Sierra Nevada.
Well, we're about out of time, but before we let you go, what's your favorite thing about working with Ellery in the field, or when you're, you know, just working with her in general? What's your favorite thing about working with her?
Well, clearly, I love her enthusiasm, and it's I think one of the things that's most enjoyable for me is to see her experience some of these things for the first time, because I've been working on glaciers for 25 years now. But I still remember the first time that she put on crampons and walked around on a glacier, or the first time that I could show her an ice cave in the McClure Glacier and she could climb up in there and explore. And it's really, really fun to watch a young person have these experiences for the first time and be able to witness it. And what's so great in Ellery's case is that she's translating that to really useful scientific study.
And do you have any plans to, you know, work with her in the near future again?
Yeah, she has a research permit to continue her work this summer. And we still have some stakes we need to retrieve from the Kuna Glacier. So I fully expect to keep on collaborating. And it's my hope that we will co-authors on a scientific publication in the not too distant future.
Wow. Well, that'll really be special. Well, Greg Stock, thanks for sharing your experiences with Ellery McQuilkin with us. And it's been a real pleasure to hear about this wonderful young person's scientific curiosity and her really just excellent work.
Yep. It's been my pleasure too. Thank you.
Thanks again to our guests, Ellery McQuilkin, junior at Lee Vining High School and finalist for the California State Science and Engineering Fair, and her advisor, Yosemite National Park geologist Greg Stock. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. You can share this program or check out past episodes and subscribe to our podcast at mynspr.org, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of A Dog Named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.